welcome to Anomalous Waves, a podcast discussing all things strange. I'm John.
I'm Ami, and this is Lilliput.
And today we're going to be discussing dogmen, werewolves, shapeshifters, and swamp dwellers.
Don't forget to check our show notes for our contact information, social media, and references for today's episode.
If you have a spooky story, a suggestion for a topic you want us to look into, or any comments, please feel free to reach out at anomalouswaves@gmail.com or any of our social media.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves.
So I specifically wanted to talk about werewolves and dogmen because I've always been fascinated with shape-shifting abilities, with the moon, and specifically werewolves. I mean, you know me, that's like my favorite movie monsters.
Mm-hmm.
In researching this, I started by going into some really old folk tales to try and see if I could find some explanations for the common movie myth kind of stuff.
Okay.
So the first thing I found was the Satyricon. This was believed to be written by Gaius Petronius, a Roman courtier, during the reign of Nero, around 54 to 68 AD, super early on, and he was known as the Judge of Good Taste.
Oh.
Now, this is a Latin work of fiction and is often described as a Roman novel, and it's satire.
Okay.
So the story revolves around a retired gladiator, Enculpius, recalling bizarre adventures from the times when he was still a slave. So with this specific section that references a werewolf, he is on his way to take his shot with a woman whose husband just passed away that he's been into for quite a while.
Ooh.
He takes this soldier who was staying at the house of his master with him to kind of just have his back. So it mentions that it's about dawn and that the moon was shown like high noon. They get to these tombstones, which would be near a roadside, and the soldier starts looking at the epitaphs of the tombstones. So he sits down and he starts daydreaming about his lady, and he begins to count the graves. The soldier, out of nowhere, starts taking his clothes off and puts them near the roadside. And he's just staring at him doing this, like super freaked out. And then the guy turns into a wolf, starts howling, and runs into the woods. So then Enculpius goes to get his clothes and sees that they have turned to stone.
What? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, that was a new one. He then, it's funny, he said that he drew his sword and he went slaying shadows all the way to his love's house. When he got to the house, the woman that he was going to kind of call on says that a wolf came and slaughtered all her sheep. But her slave apparently stabbed the wolf in the neck. So he ran back to the site where the clothes were, and all that was left was a pool of blood. No more stone clothes. He went back to his master's house, and the soldier was in bed with a neck wound and had a doctor looking after him. He said after knowing that this guy was a werewolf, he couldn't really sit down to dinner with him anymore.
Yeah, it'd be a little hard.
So, really cool story. I mean, between 54 and 68 AD, I mean, that's a really old account of a shape-shifting. Mentioned the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Mentioned him disrobing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a, you know, common thing as well.
I think the only ones that I've seen that haven't done that are Twilight, where they just get ripped shorts.
Oh, yeah.
They get jorts.
Yep, that's all you need. The other thing about that story was, by a road.
Mm-hmm. We love roads.
We love roads.
We love roads.
You're going to say it like 10 times during this because I got a lot of roads. So then I found another story from the Gervase of Tilbury. This is in the Osha Imperialia from 1215. Now, this is called an example of speculum literature, which is like a medieval encyclopedia.
Okay.
So it states, "One thing I know to be of daily occurrence among the people of our country is the course of human destiny is such that certain men change into wolves according to the cycles of the moon." He also tells a story of a knight, Rainbow de Puget, who was wandering alone in the wilderness, deranged by extreme fear. He lost his reason and turned into a wolf. He apparently encountered a woodsman who cut off his paw, and that transformed him back into a human. It also states that he confessed this in public so that there were many more witnesses to the tale. He also mentions a man named Jacques Vert and says, "When the time has come, Jacques Vert parts company from all his friends, lays his clothes under a bush or a secluded rock, and then rolls naked in the sand for a long period of time until he takes on the shape and veracity of a wolf, gaping for prey with a wide open mouth and yawning jaws." So another account of taking off the clothes, this time hiding them under a bush or something.
That's actually not very
leaving
smart.
Them on the side of the road.
Yeah.
Okay, so after finding some of the folk tales, I looked into clinical lycanthropy or werewolf syndrome. Now, lycanthropy is the supernatural transformation of a person into a wolf, but clinical lycanthropy is an extremely rare disorder where someone believes they're changing into a wolf.
Uh-oh.
Dr. Jan Dirk Blum, professor of psychiatry from the Netherlands, has only found 13 cases that could be considered clinical lycanthropy since 1850.
Only 13?
Only 13. Actually, 56 cases that he found of people who believe they were turning into animals, but only 13 could be considered clinical lycanthropy.
Hmm.
So there were also cases of people believing they were turning into dogs, boa snake, a frog, and even a bee.
A bee?
Yeah, that one. Weird. So many times this condition accompanies another disorder, such as schizophrenia or severe depression. Mm. The first case report on clinical lycanthropy was published in 1852 and described a man admitted to an asylum in Nancy, France, who was convinced that he had turned into a wolf. To demonstrate this, Blum explained, the man parted his lips with his fingers to show his alleged wolf's teeth and complained that he had cloven feet and a body covered with long hair. He said that he only wanted to eat raw meat, but when it was given to him, he refused it because it was not rotten enough. So the weird part about that is that it talked about cloven feet. That's more like a hoof rather than like wolf paws.
Yeah, more in like demon territory.
Exactly. All these people that experienced this physically felt the sensations that they were growing claws, they were becoming hairy, and growing fangs. Scientists believe that this has something to do with the region of the brain that is responsible for movement and sensation and gives us the sense of physical self. So they think something was tampered in that region of the brain, and that's why they can feel these physical sensations.
Weird.
But very rare.
Yeah.
It's talked about, but it's way more rare than it's even talked about.
Because even 50-something cases in that amount of years is pretty rare.
13 wolf-type things. And he even talked about hooves, which is different.
Yeah.
So after that, I started finding a lot of werewolf connections to witches. So most people know about the Salem witch trials starting around 1692, but there were also many witch trials all around Europe in the 15 and 1600s. And sometimes the people were also accused of lycanthropy. So this is the story of Pierre Bergot and Michael Verdun. In 1521 in Polonais, France, two men were accused of lycanthropy, witchcraft, and cannibalism. Pierre gave a full confession. He said that 19 years earlier, there was a storm that was so bad it scattered all of his sheep. He went looking for them and ended up meeting three men in black on horseback. Now, one of these men said they could find his sheep, make sure he was protected, and give him money as long as he served the man's master. He found all his sheep and went back to meet the man, who, of course, you probably guessed it, happened to work for the devil. And this man's name was Moisette. So Pierre did what he needed to do. He rejected Christianity and swore allegiance to the devil. He served the devil for a few years. He was protected. And then, well, the article that I read pretty much said he got bored and went back to church. But that is apparently where he met Michael Verdin, who convinced him to go back to the devil to get that dough, get that money. Because that was the part he didn't do yet. They then went into the woods to perform a ceremony and learn to become werewolves. This involved dancing, you know, getting naked and rubbing a salve all over their bodies. I think it even said Michael rubbed it all over his body. They also mentioned an ointment that turned them back into human shape. So then they talk about killing some people. I'm not going to get into the details, but they talk about eating flesh, drinking blood, and even killing some children while they were in human form. So Brigo also mentioned that he had to take his clothes off to transform into a wolf, but Verdin did not. He could do it with his clothes on. Like Twilight.
Did his pants turn into jorts? That's the real question.
They just mesh into the body.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry, jorts. Jorts is cooler.
So another, probably the most famous case, is Peter Stubb, who goes by tons of other names.
Mm-hmm.
He has many aliases, but also the Werewolf of Bedburg. So he was a wealthy farmer in the rural community of Bedburg, which is in Cologne, Germany. So in this village, there started being tons of cattle mutilations, and they suspected a wolf. And then there happened to start being a lot of missing children.
Uh-oh.
And missing women. And they started finding some of their bodies mutilated. They would sometimes find just limbs, and sometimes find nothing at all. The story told by George Bohr, who wrote The Damnable Life and Death of Stubb Peter, just 2 years after his trial, goes like this. The limbs of several missing people were found in a field, and a group of hunters got together and decided to find this wolf. They looked for this creature for a few days when they finally saw it. They chased this wolf down, and when it was cornered, they discovered it was not a wolf, but Peter. During his trial, he confessed to the murders, sorcery, and that he had a magic belt of wolf fur given to him by the devil when he was 12 years old. Now, the belt is what allowed him to transform into, Peter says, the likeness of a greedy, devouring wolf, strong and mighty, with eyes great and large, which in the night sparkled like brands of fire, a mouth great and wide, with most sharp and cruel teeth, a huge body and mighty paws. Now, Peter, his daughter, and his mistress were all executed on October 31st, 1589. They even displayed the wheel that he was tortured on. And then above that, the likeness of a wolf. And on top of that, his severed head warn other devil worshippers. This leads me into some more modern sightings of werewolf type creatures.
Okay.
Which a lot of times are called dogmen. So one is called the Michigan Dogman. And this is one of the first recorded encounters of this modern type of dogman. It was in 1887 in Wexford County, Michigan, where two lumberjacks reported seeing a creature with a man's body and a dog's head in the woods. Now, Rachel Clark with the Michigan History Center says that many of the early reports were around that time and usually from the men working in the woods or alone and near isolated roads. She says, their encounters are very similar, though. They do talk about this beast coming out of the woods. It is very agile. It jumps in front of their car or in front of them It scratches at their houses or their tents. So there's many more sightings of the Michigan Dogman.
Yeah.
So another really popular one is the Beast of Bray Road. I'm going to read one of the first reports, and this is from MilwaukeeMag.com, The Legend of the Beast of Bray Road. Mark Shackelman arrived at St. Coletta School for Exceptional Children a little before midnight. He carried his flashlight on his belt. As the night watchman for the school, he walked these grounds every night. The school was located inside a former Franciscan convent outside Jefferson, and the grounds covered several old buildings, an orchard, and wide open fields where several old Native American burial mounds had been preserved. The year was 1936. Shackelman was in his 30s, a husband and father, working the uneventful job for a paycheck to support his family. In rural Jefferson, there wasn't much to worry about, save the possibility of a burglar or some teenagers playing a prank. That night, Shackelman was crossing the fields when he saw a shadow. He squinted to see what it was. A hunched form was on all fours, digging into one of the mounds. From the canine way it dug, it could have been a dog or maybe a wolf, but even from afar, Shackelman could see that the thing was far too big for that. Suddenly it looked at him, and then it stood up. The sleek, hairy body unfurled to over 6 feet tall. It had a shaggy canine face, but beneath the thick fur, the muscular body of a man. A low growl echoed across the field. He smelled rotting meat. His heart beating fast, trying to control his breath, Shackelman stepped back. With sudden violence, the thing turned and ran off into the trees and was gone. The next night, Shackelman returned to St. Coletta for his usual rounds. As he walked the fields, he saw the shadow again, digging into the same mound as the night before. This time, he gripped his flashlight tight, ready to run or swing if need be. Again, it stood up. This time, it opened its mouth. Shackelman saw fangs hanging down from its teeth and its lips pulled back in a snarl. It growled at him, its speech half human and half beast. He didn't move, and again the creature turned and left. He never saw it again, but the horrendous growl, the way it seemed to speak to him, stuck in his mind for years afterward. Yeah, so that is one of the first accounts of that area.
Wow.
So much later in the 80s and 90s, there were many more reports of this creature, centralized around the town of Elkhorn, Wisconsin. So it also discusses in 1999, an 18-year-old girl driving down Bray Road hit something. She got out of her car and saw a massive wolf-like creature standing on two legs. She hopped in her car and drove off. It leapt on the back of her car but slid off in the slick rain and she sped home. After coming forward with her story, many other reports came out, and that's when Linda Godfrey got on the case. It says she was skeptical at first, but became involved after seeing how sincere the witnesses were. So she's written many books on the subject, and I'm super excited to jump in to some of her work and learn more about these modern dogman sightings. So once again, just to leave off, a road theme running throughout my research here.
We love roads. We'll be discussing the legend of the Rougarou. It is a creature with a human body and the head of a dog or a wolf. Yeah. So it stands upright on two legs and it's covered in hair with many sharp, frightening teeth.
Sounds very similar.
Its fingernails are said to be like grizzly claws. The legend of the Rougarou is a little uncertain. They don't know if it came either directly from French settlers to Louisiana, the French-Canadian immigrants from centuries ago, or if it was adopted from the native tribe legends from the area. In the Cajun legends, the creature is said to prowl the swamps around New Orleans. Iruguru is said to shapeshift between animal and human forms at will.
Not phases of the moon.
Not phases of the moon.
Very cool.
This legend was used as a cautionary tale. The Iruguru was said to hunt down and kill Catholics who did not follow the rules of Lent, and it was used to make children behave.
Like all stories
like that. Like all. So the creature originates from a similar beast called the Loup-Garou, which appears in medieval French folklore. When children would go missing, property was stolen, or weird things were afoot, it was usually blamed on the Loup-Garou. So a newspaper called Hamoa Today ran an article in 2007 called "Rougarou Keeps Its Claws in Local Lore." It was written by Laura McKnight. Laura interviewed locals about this bayou monster and got their take on what they believed the creature was and the stories they heard growing up. The creature appears as a dog in a tale told by the late John Verrett Sr. in the book Swapping Stories, Folktales from Louisiana. Verrett said his uncle and cousin were returning from visiting neighbors down the road when a dog appeared beneath the bright moon and began chasing the pair. When they jumped a fence, the dog disappeared, leaving a large man in its place. Another story says it was a were-creature who kidnaps little children at nighttime and cuts them into little pieces for fish or crab bait.
Ugh.
Yeah. So this creature seems to not have any redeemable qualities. While looking up stories, I couldn't find one where he helps people. He just seems to have an insidious agenda. An article also ran this past summer called "The Rougarou, Louisiana's Cajun Werewolf." It was written by Darcy Nadell, who is a graduate student who spends her free time writing and learning everything she can about cryptozoology, aliens, and the unusual. My kind of gal. Darcy found that local stories say the Rougarou roams the streets at night, antagonizing people to attack it.
Come at me, bro.
Yeah. Bring it. When the first drop of blood is drawn, the creature returns to human form and tells the attacker who it really is. If this witness tells anyone about this encounter, within a year and a day, they'll become a Rougarou themselves.
Wow.
Other variations say that a Rougarou can turn their victims merely by making eye contact. Okay, Rougarou is also often associated with the Honey Island Swamp Monster.
This one I was excited to hear about.
It sounds cute, but I don't think it is. It's not. A cryptid that is said to have called the Honey Island Swamp home for decades. Most sightings of this creature come from hunters and fishermen who claim to have encountered the giant hairy creatures or have found their footprints. The Honey Island Swamp is a marshland that is located in Louisiana in St. Tammany Parish. Now, Pearl River Ecotours has stories on their website about this legend. Do you want to hear one?
Of course.
Okay. Okay, so the first documented sighting of the Honey Island Swamp Monster took place in early August of 1963. Harlan Ford, a retired air traffic controller, and his friend Billy Mills were veteran hunters that claimed that while out in the swamps, they came across a large creature standing over the body of a dead boar. The strange creature had apparently ripped the boar's throat completely out. Harlan described the creature as being covered in dingy gray hair, with longer hair hanging from its head. The two estimated the creature weighed close to 400 pounds and stood about 7 feet tall. The creature's amber eyes and horrible stench were the two things that stuck in Harlan and Billy's minds the most. In the book, The Legend of Bigfoot by T.S. Mart and Mel Cabre, it states that the Honey Island Swamp Monster is broad-chested with a lean body. It approaches campsites or humans for food, but is otherwise passive and seen alone. Okay, so it has 3 or 4 toes with reptile-like claws that are up to 10 inches long, but the heel and arch have ape characteristics. Yeah, it's
big, kind of... Big mix.
Yeah. It roams the backwaters of Honey Island Swamp, which is about 20 miles long and 7 miles wide. So I'm a little reluctant to bring this up, but many reports of this big guy always include the detail about how stinky he is. In the Legend of Bigfoot book, it lists its main characteristics as having a strong odor. Well, that is something that nobody wants to be associated with. And to quote Animal Planet, horrible smell that permeates the air long after the beast is gone. So local tribes of the area have their own tale of this creature, and they call it Letic. So I'm just going to put this out here. It is personally important to me not to generalize legends as only Native American in origin. My goal is to always include the exact tribe, since all tribes have their own legends and beliefs. With that being said, there are 8 recognized tribes in the state of Louisiana, and I could not find the exact tribe associated with this legend, but found that the Choctaw tribe had bands in this area of Louisiana. In the Letic legend, this creature is described as a meat-eating, human-like creature that lived in the water and on the land. It is believed that the swamp monster was once an abandoned child who was raised by alligators in the deep, dark regions of the swamp.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. Cajuns call the creature Loup-garou, which some say means werewolf. And as you could probably tell, the Honey Island Swamp creature is also linked to my main man, Bigfoot. But they think that it is a Bigfoot that adapted to fit its swamp environment, so it got web feet. One of the kind of far-fetched theories I found came from fandom.com, where they say the Honey Island Swamp Monster legend revolves around a train wreck, which allegedly occurred near the Pearl River in the early part of the 20th century. According to this legend, the train was full of exotic animals from a traveling circus.
Oh.
Yeah. Just gear up. The animals fled into the swamp after the train derailed. While most of the creatures would soon perish in the harsh swampland, the legend goes on to tell us that a troop of chimpanzees managed to survive and even went on to interbreed with alligators.
What's wrong with that? That sounds very legit.
Yeah. The result was a strange colony of reptilian-like mammals. Now, I also found a weird story about a creature sighting in the 1970s in St. Tammany Parish, where we now know the Honey Island Swamp Monster calls home. I found it through a blog from someone who calls himself the Ghost Rougarou. They did research during COVID lockdowns on this creature. They had a link on their website to a sighting someone submitted to the Gulf Coast Bigfoot Research Organization about the encounter they had in 1976. Here's what the person says happened. Back in 1976, in the fall semester of the school year, I was attending the seminary there. During the evenings, I would usually walk the little road located behind the monastery and seminary buildings to say my rosary. Behind the buildings is a garage housing the cars for the monks. There's a field directly behind this, which leads to the piney woods. The field is fenced in since the monks sometimes would let the cattle graze there. I was saying my rosary when I began to hear a soft whimpering sound coming from the forest area. I was familiar with the noises made from foxes, cattle, and other animals in the area, so it gave me some alarm to hear this strange sound. It sounded like a mixture of a dog whimpering and a human voice crying. I could also hear the snapping of branches as the creature moved in the woods. Needless to say, I was stunned. I listened to hear what the creature would do because I could tell it was following a path in the woods, heading toward the edge of the wooded area near the field. I just knew it was going to come out in the open, but it stopped right at the edge. I could hear the sound more distinctly now. I turned to run toward the monastery in order to alert someone, when I just stopped and thought, no, nothing was going to hurt me. Besides, I didn't want the creature to be alarmed at my running and disappear, so I stayed and looked towards the woods. The creature paced back and forth, as if it could see me there, and just kept making this strange whimpering sound. After about 15 minutes, it started to back off and return into the woods. Another 5 minutes to make sure it had truly gone, and I just hightailed it to my room. I didn't know what to report since there had never been any talk of other seminarians seeing or hearing something as such. And I didn't want the seminary professors to think I was having illusions. But I knew this was something to keep in mind. A few years before, there had been reports of Bigfoot in the St. Tammany area, which had caused quite a stir, even prompting someone to write a song of all things. But I wasn't one to chalk my event to Bigfoot as yet, until I was watching a program relating to Bigfoot a few years later. The show had a recording, reportedly of a Bigfoot. When the recording was played, my heart just stopped. That was exactly the sound I could remember from my encounter. Ghost Rougarou has so many interesting sightings in southeastern Louisiana of this creature. Be sure to find the link in our show notes. And now it is time for spooky news.
Israel's former space security chief, Haim Eshed, has made claims that we have been in contact with the Galactic Federation of Aliens and President Donald Trump knows about it. He states that the unidentified flying objects have asked not to publish that they are here. Humanity is not ready yet. The 87-year-old respected professor and retired general has a book coming out called The Universe Beyond the Horizon, Conversations with Professor Haim Eshed. It is written by Hagar Yani, who is a two-time recipient of the Geffen Award for Best Original Hebrew Fantasy. Eshed says that they have been waiting until today for humanity to develop and reach a state where we will understand in general what space and spaceships are. He made several bold, unsubstantiated claims, including there is an agreement between the U.S. government and the aliens, and they have signed a contract to do experiments here. There's an underground base in the depths of Mars where American astronauts and aliens mingle, and that aliens from all over the universe are already walking among us. Nick Pope, a former UFO investigator for the British Ministry of Defense, suggested that either this is some sort of practical joke or publicity stunt to help sell his book, perhaps with something having been lost in translation, or someone in the know is breaking ranks. When asked why he is revealing this information now, Eshed says, "If I had come up with what I'm saying today 5 years ago, I would have been hospitalized. Today, they're already talking differently. I have nothing to lose. I've received my degrees and awards. I am respected in universities abroad." A NASA spokesman stated, "Although we have yet to find signs of extraterrestrial life, NASA is exploring the solar system and beyond to help us answer fundamental questions, including whether we are alone in the universe." NBC, who covered the story, wrote that the White House and Israeli officials did not immediately respond to NBC News's request for comment.
Last episode, we talked about the mysterious monolith that popped up in the middle of the Utah desert. There has since been many other monoliths pop up all across the globe. Here is a timeline of all the places this monolith has made an appearance. The Utah monolith disappeared on November 27th, and Sylvan Christensen claims he and a group of men dismantled the monolith to protect the nature in the area. The same day, halfway around the world, a second monolith appeared on the plateau near an archaeological dig in the city of Piatra Neamț in Romania. Neamț culture and heritage official Josana said, "It is on private property, but we still don't know who the monolith's owner is yet. It is in a protected area on an archaeological site. Before installing something there, they need permission from our institution, one that must then be approved by the Ministry of Culture." this monolith disappeared on December 1st. Back in the United States, a day later, on December 2nd, the third monolith appeared in the top of Pine Mountain in California. Since then, Wade McKenzie has claimed he built the monolith with the help of his friend Travis Kenny, Kenny's father Randall, and Jared Riddle. On December 3rd, under less mysterious conditions, a monolith popped up outside of a candy shop in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But unlike the other metallic structures that have appeared and disappeared, this one was intentionally placed outside the candy shop by the store owner, and he had a friend make it to help support his small business. On December 6th, a monolith appeared in a family's front yard in Washington, D.C. Bill Anderson told Fox 5, his family left the house Sunday morning for a walk. The family returned around noon and found the monolith there in the front yard. The sun was up and it was gleaming off it. We pulled in and it was pretty spectacular, he said. Anderson said neighbors didn't notice anything happening in the meantime. He said his security cameras didn't catch anything since the batteries had died. On December 7th, a monolith popped up on Compton Beach on the southwest coast of the Isle of Wight. My wife and I were walking our dog on our favorite beach and saw the monolith, local resident Lee Peckham told CNN. We hadn't heard about it at all, but clearly others had, as there were lots of people coming down to look at it. And on December 9th, a monolith appeared in Kentwood, Michigan. News 8 reports that the object is made of a duller metal and not as shiny as some that have popped up elsewhere in the world. Where will the monolith make an appearance next?
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves.
If you have any stories you'd like to share, send them to anomalouswaves@gmail.com. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
You can find all of our contact information, as well as our social medias, and all the references for today's show, including spooky news.
Until next time.
Bye.
Goon Lashish. Lily, come say bye.